Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the Royal Blue podcast. As I'm your host, Chris Beasley, joined by my colleague, the Everton Echo, Echo's Everton correspondent, Joe Thomas, and our regular guest and official Everton statistician, Gavin Buckland, as we chew the fat on following Everton's 2-0 defeat to Manchester United at Old Trafford. Joe, I'll start with you. You were sat next to me there in the press box. It was a bright start from the Blues. First 10 minutes, actually, they were all over United, but then they went down the other end, got a penalty, and that was that.
Yeah, really disappointed, to be honest, Chris. Really disappointed. And not because I subscribe to the belief. I've seen it in a few match reports, and it was the tone of some of the questioning in the pre-match, in the post-match press conference after the game as well. This idea that Everton had more than 20 efforts on goal and therefore were somehow unlucky because they laid siege to Manchester United's goal. And it seems that that was the view of some people who were watching, but it really wasn't my view. Maybe it's become a bit fatigued because we've seen this story time and time again. For those of us, like everybody listening, who's followed the Blues up and down the country and seen this story play out time and time again, I'm disappointed because I think there was an opportunity here. I think the first 10 minutes showed us that with a bit of guile and a bit of endeavour, there was perhaps a positive result against what I think was a very, very average Manchester United side. I still thought that after they went 1-0 down, I thought they still got into... I don't think they created particularly good opportunities, but I thought they created opportunities to create good chances, if that makes sense. Yes. They got in and around the box all right. I think Manchester United, once they went 1-0 up and certainly once they went 2-0 up, kind of subscribed to the notion that the easiest way to play against Everton is to give them possession and they won't do anything with it. But I think that was a little bit complacent because what Man United were possibly forgetting is that they can't actually defend. But unfortunately, a team that can't really defend against a team that can't really attack just ended up in a game that was decided by two penalties that, you know, were really, really poor mistakes to concede. And really, although Man United weren't really going for it that much, with the exception of the Lewis Dobbin challenge, I actually think that Man United were close to scoring a third or a fourth, and I think we're scoring a first and a second. But I don't think it needed to be that way, and that therefore frustrates me.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the complaints seem to be from people who are watching regular United watchers. They're obviously frustrated by the fact that a lot of their opponents are getting more chances than them. But as Gav says, and as Erik ten Hag said, Gav, they were low quality chances. Would you subscribe to that view?
Low quality chances. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. The Premier League to a 3 minute highlights package, you know, at the end of each game, it just goes on, I think, their YouTube channel, whatever it is, on the official site. And in the 3 minutes, the only Everton opportunity they showed was the Dobbin one that actually went across, wasn't even a cross shot, was it? It was probably cross, but whichever. And I think that spoke volumes for you know, what you're talking about there, about the quality of our chances. Yeah. If that was it, if that was our best opportunity, you know, God knows what the other 24 or 23 shots looked like. And most of them are just, you know, straightforward shots at the goalkeeper with a little pace. We had the one, I think we thought we could have done more, was the McNeil one right on the stroke of half time. Yeah. You know, he got the ball around the penalty spot, just a little bit further out. And he had a goal to shoot at. There was nobody by him. And instead of doing it to the left, he sort of tried to shoot inside and just hit one of their men and bounced to safety. And that was probably the best opportunity we should have made more of it. Mm-hmm. But it's that lack of composure as well, isn't it? The Inanna one, was it the Garner save, wasn't the first half, and came back to Inanna, he just smashed it over the bar when he had time to take a touch. But I agree. I think you said beforehand, Chris, and I think it's a point well made, that actually in the West Ham game we did have quality chances, didn't we? That we did fail to take advantage of. And I don't know what you think, Chris. It was different, wasn't it, on Saturday?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Joe and I were sort of both looking at this ourselves. I mean, we following the game there, and we saw the BBC, I think, on their headline, Joe, had something like wasteful Everton and spurn chances again. I said, I'm not seeing this. And you were the same. Neither of us were seeing that. And like I said, it was a bit of a narrative from, I think, the Manchester-based press. I mean, they've obviously concerned because it does seem to be a habit for United, and probably against greater opposition than Everton, it could prove costly. But they were being kept at arm's length, and it was very... I would use the word impotent Everton attack again. Now, it really was like that. They, like I said, they weren't decent opportunities at all. And that was a big difference because, I mean, if it was something that was said to Sean Dyche in his post-match press conference, you know, same again, Sean, and that was, I suppose, an easy way in for him. But I don't think it was like that at all.
No, no. I think it's probably a little bit of a concern as well that that seems to be the way that Sean Dyche is, at least publicly, viewing it. Because, again, it became a post-match press conference that was very much about that we're doing everything right. Yeah. You know, we're just not quite getting those finishes. But the stats and the facts will pay us back and we keep, you know, eventually this will turn. And I have some sympathy for that point because it was a point that was made at the start of the season after those frustrating defeats against the likes of Wolves and Fulham and games like that. And in fairness, the stats did start to pay back. Things did come back towards Everton. And we had, you know, that there's the big run of four wins in a row that we all remember so well. But the good run actually started a lot earlier than that at Brentford and continued for quite some time. You know, it was months without Everton having suffered defeat away from Merseyside. So, you know, there is a degree of, you know, truth in what he's saying. But obviously, we're at 11 games now, and that's a real concern. And I think that, you know, when people listen to this say, why don't you press Sean Dyche more when you question him? It's very, very difficult, particularly when you have a manager that kind of, obviously, he has his narrative, what he wants to set, and he's very much someone that will answer the question that he wants to answer rather than one that you've necessarily put to him. And I think that's something that we kind of see in these moments, such as at the weekend, because I think that if he was perhaps to be a little bit more open about what some of the issues were, then I think he could probably engender a lot more sympathy. Because I think a lot at this point, because I think what he perhaps needs to realise is that sometimes he isn't speaking to other journalists. He might be speaking to other journalists in the room, but really he's speaking to the fans. And what you got is you've got a fan base here that has been through absolute misery for 2.5 years. They got 3 weeks without a game now. They're 11 games without a win in the Premier League. They face a points deduction, but you know, they face a prospect of a takeover by a group who, you know, are controversial at best. We'll leave it at that for the time being. Yeah. And potentially another points deduction coming up. You know, what you're doing there is you want, at the very least, ideally you want some reassurance or some positivity. You want some positivity going into this 3 weeks without a break. But at the very least, you want some reassurance that he's perhaps sees the same things that we're seeing and is willing to address them. And I think that the frustrating thing for me is twofold. One, this continued perception that they're creating high-quality chances. They didn't at Old Trafford. They did at West Ham. They did at West Ham. But they didn't at Old Trafford. And secondly, it's a kind of a lack of willingness. I asked him about this after the West Ham game. And someone else asked him about this after the Manchester United game. Is clearly defence is becoming an issue over the last few games. You know, for so long, most of the season, Everton have struggled in front of goal.
Yeah.
But they've always had a really solid, competent, switched on defence for 90 plus however many minutes to fall back on. And in the last three or four games, that hasn't happened. Last minute goal against 10 men of Brighton, costly. You know, two last minute, you know, a header from a set piece, and then two last minute, you know, stoppage time goals against West Ham, costly. And two absolutely daft penalty, you know, concessions in this game. Yeah. Everton were out of this game after that second penalty went in. We all know that. And I think that sometimes it might be handy just to kind of almost show a little bit more awareness of where the fans are. And look, you know, Sean Dyche knows this game far more than I do, and he knows these players far more than I do, and he has got all the stats and the facts, and he'll have far more ideas and about, you know, how to get out of this slump than I do. I'm not saying, you know, casting any aspersions along those lines. But trying to say that the defence hasn't become an issue in the last few weeks and hoping that people believe that is perhaps a little bit naive.
You said that on the pod on Friday, that the defence has been a little bit rugged. Yeah. When you see like two goals a game for like the last four or five matches. Just one thing I forgot to say, and I think this summed up where we are as an attacking force on Saturday, was the Dobbin opportunity or cross, whichever way you talk about it. You want to look at Calvert-Lewin there. I watched it again a couple of times. When the cross comes in, I think it does Godfrey head it back, I think. I think cross goal. and Calvert-Lewin's facing Godfrey. When the ball goes towards Dobbin, Calvert-Lewin's not turned his back to see where the ball has gone. So by the time the ball's come in, he's not alert enough. If he'd have been alert enough and turned his back straight away when the ball had gone past him, it would have been simple tapping. Tapping for him. The fact that he didn't face the play quickly enough meant that he was, you know, he was struggling to get to the ball. And that just summed up where we are, I think, isn't it? Attacking forward. You know, a good striker in form stays alert there. And it's a dead easy thing to knock the ball in. Whether Dobbin meant it was across, I don't know. But Calvert-Lewin, short on confidence, now he'd come off the bench and stuff. You're not attuned to the game, are you? You're not looking for opportunities. And I thought that single incident summed up where we are as an attacking force, I think, on Saturday, and where Calvert-Lewin is as a player.
Yeah.
I thought it wasn't the best bit of striker action you'll see.
Is it because of that, Gav? Do you think that the defensive issues that Joe's just spoken about are creeping in? Because when you're that reliant on your attackers to do something and they're not doing something like that, I mean, Beto got one against West Ham, but I think that was his only goal in... But okay, most of them were all cameo substitute appearances, about 15. Calvert-Lewin, what's he up to now? Is it 22, something like that? If it's not going in you've almost got to be like immaculate, haven't you, at the back? And then that's where the problems are, because you can't just focus that.
A couple of things, you know, the team starts lacking confidence, and that infiltrates the defence, doesn't it, then? If up front, you know, it's not happening for you. I think that's a key thing. Also means the opposition have got more confidence now than that Everton, which is a little bit like what United were on Saturday, as you say. Like, you know, they're not going to score against us, so we can attack with a bit more freedom. And I know every goal, I think you can stop, but the Brighton game, Brighton 3 against West Ham, 2 against United, that's 6 goals, and you could argue that all 6 should have easily been, you know, stopped. I mean, we've conceded 5 goals to bang average Man United team this season, 3 of them being penalties. It's totally frustrating.
I think that's only the 6th time that Manchester United have won by margin of more than one goal this season, but it's the 2nd time that they did so against Everton.
And that speaks volume. So it was frustrating. That thing, I felt this watching, as I say, went on Saturday. Once you know, went 2-0 up after whatever it was, 20 minutes, I just think it's going to be a hard slog this, and it was just going through the motions in the second half, wasn't it?
Well, Joe, you mentioned there that, you know, they can be got, we all know they've obviously got an expensively assembled squad, Manchester United, world class players in there, but I was looking, Crystal Palace gone there and won this season, Bournemouth have gone there and won 3-0 this season, Marco Silva's Fulham have gone there and won, so they can be got out, but in the end that was like the most routine of victories for them.
And I think that's a little bit of a frustrating thing around where we are this season. You know, not as if the defeat at home to West Ham was bad enough, you didn't see what was a very poor Burnley side go there and very, very nearly beat them. And we've seen a couple of times where it feels like Everton have just missed out on what would be a surprise and a good victory or good result. But then you see someone else could play the same opposition who you think is weak. You think was weaker than Everton, go and get a positive result. An even better result there following up, and you think maybe it was more of a missed opportunity than we perhaps believe. But I just think that, you know, you look at that Manchester United side, and that defence. Victor Lindelof's playing at left back. Like, I mean, surely any attacker worth his salt wants to have a go at Lindelof at left back, playing out of position like he is there. You look at Johnny Evans. I mean, he's late 30. he's had a brilliant career.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago. It was only in the summer that we thought he might be coming here.
We're signing
that.
Johnny Evans.
There was a comment, wasn't there, on one of the
training ground
on the audio pictures, on a training ground video, wasn't there? That sounded like someone was saying that he was on his way to Finch Farm. You look at that. Even Varane's getting. Him and the Casemiro, the trophies that they've won, but. If Varane's out of contract at the end of the season, may well not have that renewed. Casemiro just kept giving the ball away. And you just looked at that first 10 minutes, and a couple of times, there aren't many Everton players that have particularly good games. And obviously, a lot of the players that showed in the first 10 minutes faded after they went 1-0 down. But that first 10 minutes, Garner won the ball back a couple of times. Everton were pushing high, they were pressing. Man United were trying to play out from the back, and they got caught every time, and that created the chances for Everton. I mean, that first 10 minutes, it almost wasn't a chance in the end because they conspired to make it not a chance, but the Onana and Godfrey kind of mix up after the first corner when the ball gets recycled, played out to them, and they just can't quite seem to work out how to get a shot on goal between them. And I mean, I think that probably what would have happened is if Everton had scored from that, if it would have been pulled back for handball from Amadou Inanna, I think. But, you know, you could see that there was an opportunity there. And even at 1-0 down, I was actually relatively impressed by Everton's response to going a goal down. Yeah, they, again, it's not that they created good chances, but they got into good enough positions to then create a good chance and just didn't quite manufacture it. And yeah, that Manchester United side isn't the strongest. Like, it's still an amazing place to go and a difficult place to go and get a positive result, as Everton know only too well. But yeah, there was an opportunity there. Everton and Manchester United, despite the disparity in their league position and the amount of money they might have spent in recent transfer windows, they're two clubs that feel like they're in very similar positions at the minute, where they're just racked by instability and uncertainty and injuries and transitions between different managers, squads and ideas. And that Manchester United side is fragile and it's vulnerable. Fulham went there and won a couple of weeks ago, didn't they? And you just think that there might have been the conditions there to go and get a positive result, but Everton didn't even give themselves a chance to do that because of these two penalties, and they were just daft.
Any complaints about the penalties, Gav? I mean, what were you all taking them all? Unnecessary challenges, I thought.
Well, that's the frustrating thing, isn't it? You can't win, can you, suppose? Because if you have got a complaint, you've got a complaint you feel hard done by. And if you haven't got a complaint, it means that one of our players has done something wrong, haven't they, really? And both players did that on Saturday. I was trying to think of which was the worst one, actually. Thought Tarkowski, I think Ashley Williams spoke about this on Match of the Day. Somebody mentioned it to me once a while back. Sometimes he tries to show that he's the hardest player on the pitch, Tarkowski, and he's just been booked, I think, for a foul on the halfway line. I think he was a bit...
Burnley training on the Sean Dyche.
And maybe he was still burning a bit of a short fuse and a bit frustrated, and that led to the first penalty. The second one, and then this happens a couple of times, and I think it's something that I think we do leave ourselves exposed. This thing about Pickford taking the free kick, in their area, just lumping it. It's because he's the goalkeeper taking the free kick. If the opposition win the ball back straight away, there's a lot of space. There's a lot of space behind the, in front of them, because it's the goalkeeper, not the defenders, taking the free kick. And that happened on, I think the penalty happened from that, didn't it? That was just a terrible challenge from Godfrey, who didn't cover himself in glory. I presume, Chris, in your ratings on...
Yes, he got the lowest one.
Yeah. And for a number of reasons, that was just a woeful challenge. And Godfrey's got history of that as well, in and around the box. A player that's going nowhere. He's not heading towards goal. He is heading across the penalty area. Yeah. And there's another player behind him. And you're getting beat 1-0 and you just need to stay in the game. You just take him out. And that was just unforgivable for me. But that reflected his performance, which I thought was poor.
Yeah. I mean, so Joe, just going back to what you said about that sort of creaking Manchester United defence. I mean, a lot of people and the sort of Manchester pack was casting an eye at Gerard Braithwaite, and it's something you've done a report on today. Gerard Braithwaite, as he was announced by the Old Trafford Stadium announcer. Whatever you're calling him. There's a few people at United might fancy a bit of
Him and Inanna, isn't it? And I think obviously Newcastle looking at the same. They had their chief scout there at Old Trafford as well, looking at a few players. I think I said it to our colleagues at the Manchester Evening News and Man United report. They were asking me about Braithwaite before the game, and I said, I said he's the type of player which, if Man United sign him this summer, it may well be that if they are to have a bit of a revolution under Sir Jim Ratcliffe and it's money and they end up fighting back at the top for trophies, Braithwaite's the type of signing that you might end up looking back and say that was the moment things changed. That was the sensible, expensive signing that you were able to build the core of a future squad of world beaters around. And I think that, to be honest, I think quite a lot of clubs around Europe are looking at that. Look, he's massive. Like, he's physically, he's incredibly impressive. Stood next to him and interviewed him a few times. You see him towering down, and you really do have a feel almost as insignificant next to Braithwaite as I do next to Gav.
He's like a young Gav Buckland.
Physically, he's so tall and strong. I mean, his recovery pace is exceptional, and his ability on the ball with both feet is good. His composure, like, he is a future star. And the sad reality is that the way in which things are at Everton, I would love to see him leading. My perfect vision of walking out at Bramley Moor for the first game is with, you know, Brownthwaite there coming out of the centre back with a captain's armband on, leaving an Everton side that we hope is all about to start making some progress into a bright new future. Sadly, I think Brownthwaite may well be doing that for a club and be the player that makes a difference for a club that's looking to move forward and take big strides in doing so. But sadly, I think it may well be away from Goodison or away from Merseyside, unfortunately. And Manchester United feels like one of several places that he would be a very shrewd acquisition for. Now, obviously, he's going to cost anybody a lot of money. He's under contract for another couple of years, and he's got good people around him. And I think more than anything at the moment, he knows that what's best for him is starting Premier League games. I think maybe even that was have coloured his approach even going into January when he was still relatively new into the Premier League, you know, set up for Everton. As he comes out towards the other end of this season, towards summer, you know, we'll have 30-odd games under his belt, well, probably closer to 40, because he did have a few in the Premier League, including, obviously, under Carlo Ancelotti gave him a senior debut, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously, you know, they've been, Real Madrid have been linked to him at various points as well, so... You know, it feels like the clubs are jockeying for position over him, and to a lesser extent, Amadou Onana over the summer. And it's going to be very interesting to see where Everton are in relation to how much resolve they can put up to interest like that, and how much they're willing to, really, depending on the club's financial situations. But, you know, Jarrod Brownthwaite would have started for Manchester United in that side, and he would have improved it quite dramatically.
Yeah, well, I think that personally, I think if Everton are still a Premier League team next season, I've seen no reason at all why, after seeing, you know, Jack Grealish go to Manchester City and then Declan Rice to Arsenal, that you can't be talking about £100 million transfer fee.
The issue will probably be how much Everton need the money and how much someone like Manchester United can potentially play on that, especially if we're in a scenario where summer transfer window starts on June the 14th of this year, and the football financial year ends at the end of the month. So there's a fortnight period, and we know that obviously Tottenham exploited Everton's desperation for a quick sale to get Richarlison for probably perhaps slightly cheaper than market value. It will be very interesting, and I'm not speaking from a position of particular clarity on this, but I think we can all see that things aren't exactly stable at Everton financially. We will learn a lot more over the course of the next few weeks when the accounts come out, and then when we also have the second commission report and its findings back. But, you know, there is a scenario there where Everton might be vulnerable to the vultures that are circling for the likes of Brownthwaite and Onana. Hopefully that's not going to be the case. Hopefully we're pleasantly surprised by the events of the coming week. And certainly, hopefully, Everton are a Premier League club at the very least when they make that decision. But I don't have any doubt that it's a decision that they're going to make as to, you know, whether or not to accept a bid for Jarrod Brownthwaite in the summer, because... Well, I mean, if I was Manchester United right now, we'd be top of my wish list, and there's probably five or other six clubs that want to be at the top of not just their domestic competitions, but also at the top of European competition. I think he would also strengthen. I think it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, Gav, if we just turn to the other player in that equation, Amadou Onana. I know you're a big fan of his ability and his potential. I mean, I incurred the wrath of the Onana fanboys over the weekend, though, in my analysis. From the game, I mentioned, just because I think he's so gifted, he's so talented, I think he should be taking these sort of games by the scruff of the neck. But again, we're talking about anything beyond the tap end. His technique for shooting is very poor, I thought. He also gave away that free kick just outside the area. That was silly. I said he fluffed his lines, and like I said, I were on the sharp end of the tongues of his admirers.
I think that's a fair assessment. I was listening to Joe's post-match assessment on Saturday, and he let slip that you and Joe have a big argument over the card and about your ratings, you know, like, so. I think, to be fair, I agree, he's got all the ability in the world, and you know what, I saw that in close quarters probably a little bit more on Saturday, thing where he's waving his arms around during the game, you know, like saying, where are you, you know, when he's got the ball, you know, I need somebody to pass it to. All them histrionics don't really help that image of him, really, that actually he's sort of not taking responsibility that he should do as a gifted midfielder in a team that's struggling. And he should be doing more. I think he should be running with the ball more than what he does. I think he's a crisp, sharp passer, but that's what he is, isn't he? He doesn't get the ball and drive in the opposition territory and get Everton forward. And I'd throw that at him. And then I think he just needs to cut out this thing with the arms during the game.
Well, it's not just teammates, it's the fans, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that's a good look from somebody. I mean, you've got to be very, very, very good and very into to get away with that during the game. And I wonder if you'd ask some of his teammates about that. I don't think they, you know, I don't know what their feelings would be, but just need to stop that. But I don't know, is he Ted Morse? Is he somebody who just thinks, well, there's a major championships coming up near the end of the season, stay fit, don't overstretch myself, I'm not sure. Perhaps he's thinking he's going. But he needs to be doing more in the moment than what he is. And start off that by being better on the ball. To be fair, and showing more visibility, which he has got in abundance, hasn't he?
Yeah, I like Onana.
I was going to say right to reply, Joe. You're the youngest man in the room here. Maybe you're close to Onana's generation.
I think you're harsh on Onana, I do, Chris. I think that he is a very talented player whose talents aren't really given much freedom to flourish in a Sean Dyche side. I think and this current Sean Dyche side at the moment, you know, I like to see him when he's got the ball at his feet and he's driving forward. We know he's a player that can turn defence into attack very quickly. But probably a good thing to look at is how many times you see anybody in that Everton side pick up the ball and run with it. It happens very, very little. I think that's probably because Sean Dyche doesn't want it to happen very often.
Yeah.
You know, he's a manager that doesn't like almost like transitions in the middle of the park because Everton can lose the ball in those transitions, and you know, certainly under Lampard it was their biggest vulnerability, what they would do when they lost the ball in not necessarily dangerous areas, but in that position when they're switching from defence into attack and they lose the ball and then they're on the back foot, that's when it became a problem for that Everton side. And I think one of the reasons it's not under Sean Dyche is he bypasses the midfield and you know it's all in the air or all down the channels in order to do that. I think another strength of Amadou Onana, when I think of Amadou Onana at his best this season, I think go back to the first game of the season and I go back to that Fulham match when he played two very good through balls, one to Neil Mope and one to Adulé Doucouré. Both created wonderful opportunities for them. I remember saying probably on the pod or writing Amadou Onana should have come out at half-time against Fulham, first game of the season, wind in his sails because he's got picked up two assists. Both of them were missed. Mope isn't even at the club anymore, or certainly you know he's on loan away from the club. When you have got him, you know, I was really impressed when I saw him. He came on at the Etihad against Man City, and obviously Everton were 1-0 down at this point. He's got some of the best players around him, closing him down, and he was sat there on the edge of the area demanding the ball for short passes, and he wanted it. But the problem is, if you're Amadou Onana and you turn and you want to release someone down on the channels and you haven't got anybody with any pace to do so or any wingers, and if you've got a striker that's you know 40 yards in front of you and is marked out the game by two centre backs that have got nothing else to occupy himself, I don't know what else he can do really. So I mean, don't get me wrong, like I think he could probably do a bit more. I don't think he's been particularly good in this run 11 games. Obviously he's missed a lot through injuries, and Sean Dyche hasn't started him when he's had the option to pick from four first choice centre midfielders. You know, Amadou Onana started a lot of those on the bench, and then that's another part of the problem. Then when you're asking him to change games that he's coming on in, you know, I thought it was a defensive move not to start him against Crystal Palace. Obviously, they didn't start him against Brighton. They didn't start him against Man City. So even then, his opportunity to grab a game by the scruff of the neck is relatively limited. Now, there's obviously a reason why Sean Dyche isn't starting him. You know, maybe it's because of form, maybe because it's tactics, maybe it's something else, and it may well be that Amadou Onana has something to play in that. But I have no doubt that he'll move on from Everton and he'll look $1 million in another side. And I think some of that's down to him, but I think some of it's also down to the players around him and also the style in which they're asking to play. Because I just think that, you know, talking about running at players, I mean, just saw it again with Ben Godfrey at right back, and I think this is part of the limitations of having a centre back there. But so often in recent games, you see him pick up the ball, maybe you know approaching the halfway line. We know Godfrey's quick, and we know he's powerful, and you see the space in front of him, and you think, just run, just run, just go into that space, get Evan up the pitch. and you get 10 yards inside the opposition half, and you'll check back and you'll pass it to Tarkowski, yeah, or you'll pass it to Pickford. And it's just that time and time and time again. And that isn't all going to be down to him. Some of that's going to be Deitch telling him not to do anymore. It's almost like he gets 10 yards into the opposition play and switch it, then he just, yeah, you know, the angel, the devil on his shoulder just goes, you know, come back. That's it. No further, or something like that. And I you know, there are definite positives of the way and the style that Sean Deitch has this Everton side playing, or trying to. When it works, it can be very effective. You know, this is this is by rights a side that, you know, should be mid-table, shouldn't have any fear of relegation now. It should really be, even if you want to try and put into context how good a job Sean Dyche has done from a broader perspective,
yeah,
this side is on its longest run without a league win in 30-odd years, and it should really only be two wins away from safety, and we're in the beginning of March.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I know when even you compare that to a lot of Everton sides, even in the Premier League era, that's still a very low threshold for success. But when you look at where this Everton squad has been in the last 2 years, you know, the situation that Deitch has inherited and the resources that he's had to try and change things around, which have diminished at every stage that he's gone through, and he's been selling players, not bringing them in, or when he's been bringing them in, is bringing them in almost with an asterisk next to name, because he's looking for players that you can only, you know, people are happy to not accept any upfront payment for them. Well, I think that shows you, and that doesn't mean I'm saying that Deitch is without criticism or anything like that. And I think that 11 games without a win is clearly a problem, and I think the failures to make more of the games, particularly in the past month, means that we're heading towards a dangerous situation now, where Sean Deitch might have to start playing the situation rather than the game. It's the situation that Everton are in rather than the games that he wants to play. That might mean changing things up a little bit, you know, to try and get wins. And that's what worries me.
Yeah.
You know, Everton might find themselves in a situation where they start to need to win games rather than need to not lose games if they're not careful. That's the danger.
I think that was brought up on the pod on Friday, wasn't it? Yeah. About that good question about Deitch doesn't set his teams up to win games. And you could argue about how many managers do that, but at some point between now and the end of the season, he probably may have to, mightn't he? And that's where it becomes difficult. I think when you say playing the situation, I think he's been doing that for a while, hasn't he? I think that whole 10-point thing, you could say he's been playing that situation, hasn't he, on occasions, as we spoke about on the pod. Would he have played certain games differently, knowing that, as you say, Joe, we are a mid-table team. So in some respects, he has been managing in an artificial environment, but that's become a lot clearer now, albeit we've still got this second commission. And I think he could get a couple of more games time, or is it Bournemouth and Newcastle.
Well, I'm just writing a piece now. Obviously, we're sitting here on the Monday lunchtime. We've got a piece ready to go, either go tonight or tomorrow at some point, and just looking at the next month. And obviously, Everton don't play for 3 weeks now. Luton play twice. They go away to Bournemouth. Could get a result there, as could Everton. Obviously, that's their next game as well. Then the thing is, they play Forest at the weekend. Luton Forest, so that's the team that are 4 points away from Everton, the team that are 1 point. So one of those teams at least is guaranteed to gain on Everton before they play again. And it could end up possibly being both. So that becomes a concern, because if you then end up in a situation where Everton go to, what, we're on the 11th of March now, well, by April the 8th, the second commission has to be concluded. So Everton Football Club will probably know. We might not know yet, because there's a bit of to and fro between the lawyers, but Everton Football Club will know what the preliminary decision is for Everton's points deduction, if they're going to get another one. Forest will also know the same. But if 11 games becomes 12, because they don't win at Bournemouth away, which is a winnable game, but it's a tough game, it becomes 13 because they don't win at Newcastle away, again, winnable, but very, very tough, then all of a sudden, they've just given the likes of Luton, mainly Luton, obviously Forest as well potentially, but they're in a similar position with points deductions, those opportunities to build some momentum that hurts Everton and makes any points deduction that does follow even more severe. That game against Burnley on the 6th of April is going to be huge, I think.
Still got to go to Luton as well, haven't we?
Still got to go to Luton. We've
got Forest at home.
We've got Forest, Brentford, Sheffield United and Burnley. So, even, like, I mean, for all that we're saying, they've got everything. They've still got everything in their hands to stay up. And, you know, but what they are going to, you know, I'd still make them big favourites to stay up, even with a points deduction which isn't greater than, a secondary points deduction which isn't greater than 4, I think Everton, you know, will still be fine. But the one thing that Everton have got to do in order to stay up this season, to keep things in their own hands, is something they haven't been able to do all season, and that is beat bang average sides at Goodison Park. Yeah. And the worry is that, you know, in the last few weeks they've had opportunity to kind of find a breakthrough on that, and they haven't been able to do it against West Ham or Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
That's the worry.
Yeah. Just finish them before we get too ahead of ourselves. Gav, obviously the immediate future this week. I mean, Sean Dyche-Schmidt, very tight-lipped about it, but we understand they have headed off to Portugal for a training camp, a working holiday, in inverted commas. I mean, he's pains to say, you know, it isn't a break as such. You know, it's very much a training camp. Do you think this could be sort of a moment to reflect and sort of recharge the batteries and reset perhaps?
Well, I think, said before, last Friday, with a club, like a squad that looks like it's played a lot of games.
Yeah.
Which they have done as individuals, haven't
they? A lot of minutes,
You know. Yeah. And on that basis, I think a three-week break is ideal.
Yeah.
For the team, for 2 reasons. A, to give them a physical break, and two, to reflect on where it's not gone to plan on the pitch, at least over the last 2 or 3 months. And I think for those 2 reasons, I think it couldn't have been timed better. You know, it could be tempered by the fact that if Luton get a couple of good results, it may be a slightly different scenario you're coming back to at Easter. But in terms of the team and their ability to win matches, I think it's an ideal break, and I hope they make the most of it, to be honest with you.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there. And thank you to our guest, Gavin Buckland. Thanks to Joe for his impassioned defence of Amadou Onana, buoyed by me placing him in the same age bracket as him. we'll be back with you soon anyway, but this has been the Royal Blue Podcast.